This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When I hear the word drought, I usually picture arid climates suffering from little to no rainfall. I picture dust, basically. But here in Vermont, we've been experiencing drought conditions for much of this year. You might have noticed trees in full summer greenery with slightly curled up leaves. That's a visible sign that there's not enough water in our soil. A more pressing sign for some Vermonters has been a dry well. We don't have statistics, but well drillers say they've been flat out all summer and fall. Today on the program, we're going to look at drought conditions we've been experiencing, how they're affecting the state, and what we might be able to forecast for any relief this coming winter and spring. Joining me are three scientists who can help us understand drought: Greg Hansen, a hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Burlington; Marjorie Gale, state geologist and director of the U.S. Geological Survey in Vermont; and Leslie-Anne Dupigny-Giraud, state climatologist with expertise in drought, also chair of UVM's Geography Department. Thanks very much to all three of you for being here today.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks.
So we got a note before the show started from a listener named Rick, who wants to know, how is drought defined? Is it simply the fact that we received less precipitation than past years? Or is there some sort of measure based upon water usage by homes and crops? And Rick goes on to share his own experience. He says, in the decade since I moved to Westford, my garden and trees have been plagued by mold due to being too wet. I specifically recall 2 years where we never saw the sun for a full month. This past year is the first year I view as having a proper balance of sun to rain. My trees were noticeably healthier. So, Leslie-Anne, how is drought actually defined?
So, Jane, when you think about trying to define drought, there are four ways that we can do this. One would be a shortfall in the amount of precipitation, rainfall, or snowfall that we get. But then we can also look at if the soils are also drying out. That's another way of defining drought. And then the third way would be to talk about the groundwater wells and the drawing down of Lake Champlain that we've been noticing. And then finally, it's when it hits your pocketbook, because drought affects us from a socioeconomic perspective, so that if the crops fail during the summertime, you can also see that in terms of higher prices in the grocery store.
So is there a specific definition, or is it squishy? It's just less precipitation than normal until we sort of see those factors and then we get to call it drought, or is drought something very specific?
Drought is very specific, and I know Greg's going to jump in, because the way that we classify drought in meteorology and climatology is slightly different from the way a hydrologist would do it.
So, Greg, how do you do it in meteorology?
Well, we're looking more for the stream flows and the overall lack of precipitation.
But is there, I'm looking for a number here. I'm trying to figure out, it sounds like, there's some drought maybe sometimes.
And,
for somebody like Rick who says, I'm feeling like everything's healthy, how do we say, no, honestly, Rick, it's drought?
The below normal rainfall is something that we take notice of early on. And we're coming out of last year, we had a snow drought, basically. We had our second least snowiest winter we've ever experienced on record here in Burlington. So, we started paying attention to that early on. But it's really when we start to see the impacts as a result of that below normal precipitation. And that really didn't raise itself until more, late September, October, I think, when some of that really started to, we hit that real dry patch there.
And the other thing, Jane, is the numbers change depending on where you are in the country. So if the number that we have in Vermont, if we give you something like 5 inches, that would be, magnified if you were in the desert southwest, for example.
Right, so 5 inches below normal in terms of precipitation.
Right.
And when
we say normal, we're talking about a 30-year average, not the sort of everyday use of the word normal as an expected. It's a 30-year average that we're talking about here.
So, Marjorie Gale, we experience these conditions differently depending on where in the country we are, but also even where in the state we are. Some people may be experiencing drought conditions and others may not.
Correct.
So what might that look like for somebody who's actually experiencing drought in Vermont or seeing it?
So for me, I'm mostly going to talk about the materials that water would be flowing through. And for the responses that we see, where a well may run dry and then recover, a well may run dry, not recover, people may notice odors in their water or a change in their water that's going to indicate low water levels, and all the factors that contribute to getting water into wells are quite different as you move around the state. We have a lot of small watersheds, and groundwater recharge tends to be quite similar to surface water recharge. So we have considerable diversity out there in terms of bedrock type and glacial deposits and soils and amount of precipitation and topography and slope, all those factors that control how the water gets to your well.
Are you hearing from people whose wells are running dry or hearing that wells are running dry this year?
We actually, so at I'm in the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, and we launched a drought report or webpage where people can put in if their wells have run dry. But I think there's only 26 actual reports, and then the rest have been more reports from well drillers that they're drilling a lot of wells this year.
Well, listeners, we'll put a link to that up on our page at vpr.net, actually, if you'd like to report what's going on with your well. And if you have a question about drought, we're talking with a climatologist, a geologist, and a hydrologist. None of us are in a bar, but we are having a conversation about drought today, and we'd love your input, your questions, your experiences. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note with your concerns and questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Josh in Richmond who says, "We've noticed that apples from this year's local crop seem particularly small. Could you comment on whether or not that might be connected to a dry summer?" Do either of you know? Leslie Ann, you're nodding yes.
And one of the hallmarks of drought across the state is it tends to accelerate the life cycle of vegetation. So instead of things blooming in July, they might be sort of late June. And the sort of smallness of the fruit is also a sort of indicator that something wasn't quite right in terms of the amount of rainfall that might have been received in the growing cycle, so that the actual yield is smaller than it could have been.
Hmm. We also got a note from John in Norwich who just shares an experience. He says, "We have a rather large garden that requires a lot of water. This summer's lack of rain could have been devastating to our garden, except for the fact that we have a year-round brook in our backyard. We bought a submersible pump and placed it in the brook, running two lengths of garden hose to the edge of the garden. We then filled 6 5-gallon buckets, transferred the water to watering cans, and hand-watered the garden constantly. The garden thrived, but it sure was labor-intensive." And McGarry writes, "From a beekeeper's perspective, it's been a hardship as well. While the early honey flow was generous and we harvested around 3/4 of a ton of honey, the mid and late season flows, which include basswood trees as well as goldenrod, asters, and Japanese knotweed, hardly materialized. Many plants were delayed in blooming, and when they did bloom, yielded little. Many beekeepers depend on the late season honey plants to provide nectar and pollen to assist in the winter survival of their colonies. This year, I was obligated to feed several hundred pounds of sugar syrup and still found colonies very light or weak in strength as I prepared my colonies for winter. I expect the lack of rain has had an impact on other pollinators as well." So, Greg, are you seeing this lack of rain having an impact on people? I mean, we've heard now from gardeners and beekeepers and apple orchards.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing that the warmth and the additional sunshine we got really was good for gardeners and for a lot of crops. And I think one thing what we've heard, too, is the trends throughout the season. And even though we've been below normal rainfall or precipitation pretty much all year, the spring snowmelt masks that to some degree. We get the spring melt, and most of that water does make it into the soil. So even if we don't see a drop of rain through April or May, that initial snowmelt kind of gets us through. It gets the farmers their first one or two cuttings of hay. It gets the early flowers going and things like that. So,
but we didn't have much snowmelt this spring, did we? I mean, wasn't it a pretty dry winter?
It was, yeah, and it came pretty early. But even that's enough to early on get the river flows up, and it really doesn't. It's not as apparent early on as say areas that don't have a snow cover all winter.
So, Leslie Ann, you were mentioning that some of the blossoms are earlier when there are drought conditions. Does that then reverse in the fall? We heard from the beekeeper who said, some of the blooms seem to be coming very late or later than normal. Does that resonate?
So I think it may be species dependent as well as location dependent. And I was really, really intrigued by the second comment that you read. Very, very ingenious ways of sort of capturing that water that did fall and then sort of redistributing it around the various places that he was trying to irrigate. And that's a sort of perfect classic Vermont example of being really ingenious with the resources that we do have. But then at the same time, if you're plants already have started and are sort of going through their entire life cycle really quickly, there's not too much that you can actually do to sort of stop that off.
Again, listeners, if you want to share your experiences or your questions about anything related to our drought conditions, from what it's like under our soil, in our bedrock, what about our groundwater supplies, to what's happening on the surface, to a forecast for this winter and what we might be able to see in terms of alleviating some of the symptoms of drier than normal weather, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Peggy is calling in from Norwich. Hi, Peggy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. We have a drilled well, and I seem to remember from many years ago that once the ground freezes, your groundwater, your well water is not going to replenish. So I'm just wondering, is there a way you can tell how your drilled well is doing in terms of supply before you open the tap one day and nothing comes out?
Yeah, Peggy, good question. Marjorie Gale, what about that? You know, are you just at the mercy of waiting until it runs dry, or can you find out how it's doing?
Without actually removing the well cover and measuring the depth to the water table, you might have some trouble. But you might also notice sometimes the water table in your well might be at a certain level and your pump is way down towards the bottom of the well, so you have a lot of storage capacity, but as the water levels drop, sometimes you might start getting some odor, some sulfur water, some sediment. You might clog your water filter. Things like that can let you know that, or a drop in your water pressure, that you might want to conserve water a bit and be sure you're not withdrawing more than is refilling every day.
Can you talk a little bit about refilling in terms of what happens underground in our groundwater supplies? Not necessarily refilling your well, but just in general, what happens when we start to experience low levels of precipitation in our groundwater supply?
Yeah, so first if you're standing on the surface, you've got soils under your feet, and then you've got glacial deposits, and they might be sands and gravels, or they might be clays. And then below that, you have fractured bedrock. So when precipitation happens, it lands on the surface, and it might infiltrate into the surficial materials or the soils. Some of it does that. Some of it runs off. Some of it evaporates. Some of it's taken up by vegetation. Some of it makes it out of the sand and gravels and finds its way into cracks in the rock. And so now it can no longer move in every direction. It can only move along cracks in the rock in very specified directions. When you drill a well, you might go through all those layers, and you go through, let's say you hit one fracture, and maybe it's not water-bearing. You drill a little deeper. You hit another fracture. It is water-bearing. You hit another one, and so hopefully you have multiple fractures and water comes in and water goes out, and you just pop your well down there and you intercept that water that is moving around through your well. So so a lot of your water can be anywhere from one day old to 100 years old. It's going to move through this system slowly. It can be inches to feet per day, or it can be feet per year. So there's water there that's stored, and first you have to lower the water table to where you would no longer be supplying some of those water-bearing fractures. That would be one way that you'd lose your supply. If you're getting a lot of your recharge from the surficial materials and the water table drops below that level, that's another way that you can start to reduce your water supply. And when the ground freezes, it can interfere with the amount of precipitation that infiltrates down and into the bedrock. But you might be fine because you can be drawing your water from a very large area once you're into the fractured bedrock. Does that help?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, it's interesting to note the differences between how you replenish water in the soil. You know, if my garden is dry, I can pop some water onto it, and it's, you know, if I can do that regularly enough, it's probably fine, and it's, you know, saturated enough. But when it comes to our bedrock water and the groundwater that we have in this state, does that get replenished as quickly if we just get one good rainfall?
Chances are it doesn't, but it's going to depend on what your which fractures are supplying your well and where they're receiving the water. What if it's a big open fracture that reaches all the way up to the surface? Then water is going to get there quickly and get to your water supply quickly. If it's a shallow dug well, those tend to respond pretty quickly to water. You know, less rain, the water level goes down. More rain, the water level pops right back up. They're pretty responsive. But once you're into bedrock, depending on the type of rock and the fractures and the rate at which the water is moving through, you could have rain, but it might take 6 months for that particular water to make it to your well.
Let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Eden. Hi, Bill. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
I have had two homes. I'm currently building my second one. The first one I doused on top of bedrock and found a line about 50 feet long, and I brought Menosh in, and they dug down and hit water at 23, 87, and 127 feet, and it ran over the casing the next morning. This new property I doused since before I had my closing. I've been dousing since May on the property near the building area, and I centered on one spot, and I hit water at 9 feet. So I'm calling in praise of dowsing, but I also wondered, when is science going to figure out why this works so well for some people and why other people can't do it at all?
Bill,
but,
thanks for calling in.
I appreciate
Yeah, I appreciate you calling in. You know, it's always interested me that maybe we should do a dowsing show someday. So you're sort of hijacking the drought show to talk dowsing, but I'm up for it. Marjorie, what do you think?
You're asking the wrong person.
I don't know. As a state geologist, you must have at least an opinion.
Personally, I know one person who was a dowser, was an excellent dowser. And before he went out on a site, he used to come in and check out all our geologic maps and materials. So he went armed with some science before he went dowsing.
So, Leslie Ann and Greg, I think Marjorie would appreciate it if I also tossed that question to you. What do you think about dowsing
I don't know that much about it.
Greg?
Yeah, me neither. I've heard people have success and no idea how it works.
Listeners, I actually would love to know what you think if you want to start a thread on our comments page at vpr.net or on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Maybe we can pop a little question up there for you and you can carry on this conversation specifically about dowsing, because it is something that a lot of people in Vermont swear by, and we're interested in hearing what you think about it. We're talking about drought today, drought conditions, and we're going to look at what this winter might bring in terms of relief. You can call us with your observations or concerns. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we've invited three Vermont scientists to look at the recent drought through the lens of weather, geology, and climate. If you have a question on drought or weather trends, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking today with Leslie Ann Dupigny-Giroux, state geologist Marjorie Gale, National Weather Service hydrologist Greg Hansen, and we'd love to hear from you. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. Can you just back up for a moment and put this in perspective for us, how bad this drought is? Leslie Ann, are we experiencing something that's, you mentioned, all of these conditions that lead us to say something is drought, including crops that don't have good yields and a hit on our pocketbooks. Are we experiencing all of that in this drought right now?
We are, actually, because if you think back maybe a month ago when we were looking at Halloween, for example, even the size of the pumpkins, the number of pumpkins available is one indicator that we didn't do as well as we could have. And that story was sort of repeated across much of northern New England. But I think one of the other pieces that we need to remember when we're in a drought is that it took us a while to get into the drought. You know, for this particular one, it's been at least 12 months that we've been sort of building up to these conditions. And so it's going to take us a while to come back out of it, even if we continue getting precipitation. And even if that precipitation continues to sort of infiltrate into the soil, like Marge, you were saying, it's one of those things that takes a while.
So, Greg Hansen, we can't just get one really big snow event, a blizzard that the ski resorts will be really happy about and say, oh, good, now we're done with drought.
Right, yeah. Another analogous situation was 2001, where we had pretty severe drought, probably worse than what we had now. I remember a lot more things of people running out of water and water hauling, a lot of that going on in addition to more wells. And that was the year that we had Hurricane Floyd come up and dump nearly as much rain as we had with Irene, with little to no flooding with that. So that's a case where we did kind of get the drought-busting rain all at once, but it was too much, and it still took more rain after that to really make it add up. We need, you know, long soaking-type rains that really have time to soak in over a long period to make it go away.
So if long soaking rains, what happens then if it's just long snows? Do we just have to wait until spring then for that snow melt?
To some extent, we do get, when we get a deep snow cover, there is a little bit of melt that goes on right at the soil surface, so there is some moisture that still gets in. You know, streams still flow. We don't freeze everything down entirely, so there is some water moving around. But yeah, you do have to kind of wait for that rest of that snow to melt in the spring.
And even if we did get a really nice deep snowpack, one of the concerns would be in come springtime that it goes slowly, because we saw what happened in 2011 when we had, you know, an amazing snowpack that went too quickly. The temperatures were too high. There was rain on snow. And then we ended up with the massive inundation flooding along Lake Champlain. So again,
we want it to be slow.
Exactly. We want a nice deep snowpack. We want, you know, ongoing precipitation. But then when it snow melts, we want that to be a nice snow melt so that it could actually get into the lakes and streams and not just run off and cause flooding.
If we have what we all learn in school, though, is a closed system, you know, with precipitation on Earth, why does it matter whether it runs off slowly and gets into the ground that way or floods into our lakes and streams and then eventually goes back into the groundwater anyway? I mean, I know why it matters in terms of economics, and certainly none of us want to see flooding. But in terms of water supplies and drought conditions, why does that matter, Leslie Ann?
I think it matters because it goes back to something that Marjorie just said, that some of this water takes about 20 years to make its way down to recharge our aquifers. And so we do need to always have water percolating and going down and not always running off. Otherwise, our aquifers will eventually dry out.
Marjorie, do you want to jump in there too on how that works and why it matters, how we're actually getting this water into the water table?
Sure. One thing would be that where the precipitation falls or where the snow is melting and it might infiltrate and be able to recharge a well in that area, if it runs off, it's going a significant difference, a distance from where it would have infiltrated and running off. And so even though your total water balance over this very huge system might be consistent, in the local areas, it wouldn't be.
Again, today we're talking about drought. We'd love your thoughts. 1-800-639-2211. Mike is calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Mike. You there, Mike?
Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I worked in agriculture in the upper Midwest for my entire adult life. I live in Middlebury now. And the whole agricultural community in that part of the world looks at the Palmer Drought Index. I believe it's calculated by NOAA, and it integrates a lot of different things like water use and evaporation, but is that calculated for New England, and is it a useful guide to the severity of drought in our part of the world?
Mike, thanks for the call. Leslie Ann, do you know about this?
So yes, both Greg and I are actually on what's called the U.S. Drought Monitor, which relies really, really heavily on that Palmer Drought Severity Index. And yes, it is calculated across the entire U.S., Alaska, U.S. territories, Mike. One of the challenges with using that in our part of the world is that it's more of an agricultural index as opposed to a meteorological index. And so there's a little bit of a lag or a delay in how well it responds to what the actual conditions are. And Greg and I have been going back and forth for the last couple of weeks trying to figure out, why does the Palmer Drought Index say that drought conditions are in the severe category for Vermont when we look at other pieces of the puzzle, including actual observations, and they don't quite jive. So
right, yeah, and it's showing the more severe drought in northeast Vermont, which is the area that had the most rain this summer. So yeah, there are some other factors in there as well. And the other thing is The Palmer Drought Index is done for climate divisions. So we've got the state of Vermont split up into three different climate divisions. And so, you know, we're looking at some really small scale, you know, the rainfall footprints are very small. Our watersheds are pretty small. And so with these larger climate divisions, you're getting some bleed over where one condition right on top of a reporting station may impact the way this entire box is colored with the Palmer Drought Index. So we tend to use that a little bit less and are looking more at, you know, the groundwater, the stream flows, the long-term precipitation deficits.
So the Palmer Drought Index is showing a more severe drought here than what you guys are experiencing or finding or hearing about?
Yeah, it's showing a more severe drought in the Northeast Kingdom, which is really interesting because, again, that's where we've had the most rain this summer. Yeah, there's something else going on, I think, with some soil moistures or some of the other.
Yeah, that's where that soil moisture piece comes in again, and always going back to see that, as you say, it's a systems approach. You have to look at all of the pieces to really get what's going on.
So where are we experiencing the worst drought in the state versus where are things maybe okay or slightly less bad?
Well, the long-term rainfall deficits right here in the Champlain Valley are about the biggest. And Leslie Ann alluded earlier that all of New England has been under drought. We've actually, in the Champlain Valley in Vermont and northeast New York, has actually been better off than southern New England and western New York. And so only lately have we had a little more drought, a little less rain. But yeah, basically the Champlain Valley, there's a stripe from Franklin County, New York, kind of southeast through the central Champlain Valley, and then on southeast through Vermont to link up into southern New Hampshire has been kind of the stripe this summer and early fall. It's been the driest.
And, Greg, has it just been a total lack of rain, as in we haven't had enough rain events, or they haven't been big enough? I mean, what conditions led us to this drought, and what conditions are going to get us out of it?
Right. Well, we've had some isolated heavy rain this summer. We did have some flash flood events. So even in the middle of the drought, you can have flooding, which is kind of interesting. And some of those rainfall rates were, you know, 2 or 3 inches an hour. We had some 4 and 5 inch rainfall amounts this summer, which are pretty impressive. And if they'd have happened over an entire month, it would have been very beneficial. But instead, kind of like what we've been talking about, it happens too quickly, causes flooding, and then runs out of the water system where we need it.
And the other aspect about drought is not just the precipitation alone, but it's also what are your temperatures doing. So if you have really, really high temperatures, really, really strong winds, and if your air is really dry, then that sort of like acts like a sponge and soaks up the precipitation that actually did fall. So it's a combination of all those factors, like Greg was saying, the precipitation, but also the high temperatures that we had, you know, all summer long. It's great to have sunny, clear, free, you know, days, but the price of that is that, you know, you're not getting that moisture into the soil like we should be getting.
So you need rain events to happen on a regular basis that offer us a significant but not a ton of rain at once. And that's what we need to keep our crops healthy and our groundwater healthy.
Yeah. And if we could just get back to normal precipitation through the winter and into next spring, you know, we would slowly see those groundwater levels recharge and come back up to where they should be.
Marjorie Gaylor, are we going to be in trouble if we don't see that? I mean, do you have real concerns for our groundwater supplies for Vermont moving forward?
So I think that we only have three good sources of data for groundwater levels in the state, and they're fluctuating. They're all, and they're in surficial wells. USGS has a real-time monitoring system, but we don't really have the data on hand or a way to collect it to tell us what historically, where our groundwater levels have been, where they are comparatively. So we know we've had a few dry wells this summer. We know we're in drought conditions, and we might expect that to get worse as time goes on if we don't get rain. So I think you would be interested in conserving some water and just developing good water use habits out there.
If I develop good water use habits, though, and I have a dug well, which I do, I really, you know, it sounds like, given what's happening around the state with our water supplies, you know, I may have great habits in terms of, you know, not doing my laundry very often and conserving water as much as possible, but I'm really at the mercy of what's happening around the state and with our water supplies in general and with the weather. So more broadly speaking, all three of you, how should we be preparing for either a continuation of drought conditions or more drought conditions moving forward as we experience these changes in our climate due to climate change? Marjorie, do you want to start?
Yeah, for the long term, because I had someone call me and ask, they had a sand and gravel well, and it had run dry before, and it had run dry again now. For the long term, you're probably safer drilling a well. You're going to be deeper. You're going to be below the water table. You're not going to be exposed to contaminants that might get into shallow surface wells as 'cause they can enter more quickly. So for the long term, drilled wells are a good option, and they cost some dollars.
Greg Hansen, what do you think? Just broadly speaking, how should we be preparing ourselves to deal with these kinds of conditions?
Well, droughts are cyclical. You know, we go through periods of floods and periods of drought. And so, you know, even if we are coming out of one, we always need to be prepared. You know, make sure your water systems in your home doesn't have any leaks, the toilet's not always running, that sort of thing, because that can be a big waster of water. And so, you know, conservation is always a good way to go.
Leslie Ann, should we be preparing for more of this? I mean, drought is cyclical. It's always been around. But are we going to experience more of this with climate change?
I think one of the things that we need to always keep at the forefront of our minds is how variable Vermont's climate is and how variable the weather is. And so as conditions continue to evolve, being flexible, nimble, and always aware of the fact that we can go from one extreme to the next, one hazard to the next, flooding to drought, one particular type of condition to the next. It's just one of those things that we need to be always thinking about holistically and not putting all of our eggs in one basket.
Leslie Ann Dupigny-Giroux is Vermont State Climatologist, also chair of UVM's Geography Department. Marjorie Gale is State Geologist and director of the U.S. Geological Survey in Vermont.
Vermont
and Greg
Geological
Hansen
Survey.
Is Hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Burlington. Marjorie, did I get it wrong?
Yeah. U.S. Geological Survey is a different entity. They have an office here as well, but Vermont Geological Survey is part of our state government.
Got it. All right. We'll make sure we get that right. Thanks for correcting me. And thanks to all three of you for being on the program today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, what is the deal with Small Business Saturday? Stay tuned. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The busiest shopping days are just ahead of us. Friday has been dubbed Black Friday, which is retail speak for jammed shopping centers and big box stores and people physically scrambling for deals. That's followed by Cyber Monday, when online sales abound. But stuck between the two is Small Business Saturday, a made-for-local shopping holiday created in 2010 by American Express. For the second year in a row, Green Mountain Transit is providing a free ride day to help Vermont shoppers reach local retailers. Karen Walton is Green Mountain Transit's general manager and the creator for Free Ride Day.
People can take part in it throughout the whole Green Mountain Transit service area, which is Chittenden County, Franklin, Grand Isle, Lamoille, and Washington County, any of our routes on Saturday that are running through that five-county area. So it'll be a fare free, which means you can hop on the bus, not have to worry about having your exact change on you. And you jump on the bus at the bus stop that's closest to you. You can find that at ridegmt.com, and you can look up where your closest bus stop is to you, and then you could take it to anywhere our system goes, including any of the major shopping areas.
And local retailers do hope you'll get to shopping areas, whatever mode of transit you use. How does Small Business Saturday and the holiday season in general impact Vermont retailers? Well, joining us now is Aaron Segrist, president-elect of the Vermont Retail and Grocers Association. Aaron, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So isn't Small Business Saturday just another gimmicky consumer holiday to get us out to shop?
I wouldn't really consider it a gimmicky holiday shopping marketing ploy. Small businesses are really the lifeblood of Vermont, and, you know, it's certainly something that not only our retailers depend on, but also I think we need to give them credit that they provide so much support to the community that it's really important to have our customers come out and support those small businesses.
How important is this time of year to local retailers?
It's pretty important. Small businesses can really make up anywhere from a third to, a quarter to a third of their annual sales during this time. Holiday shopping, as you know, is the busiest time of year. So it's very important to our small businesses here in Vermont.
That probably goes for almost all retailers in terms of the importance of holiday shopping season. Is it just that the margins are often so much smaller for small local businesses that this is really make or break for them?
I think it has something to do with the margins, but it's also got something to do with, their requirements and really the financial burden that the smaller businesses carry. As a small business, your margins are much smaller, but the regulations are the same for you as they are for, say, a larger retailer. So there's a significantly smaller margin for a small business than there is a larger retailer.
So what are you expecting this year in terms of holiday sales numbers? I mean, I know we haven't gotten through it yet, so we can't obviously say what it is, but are you thinking optimistically for this holiday season?
We are optimistic. We're anticipating, a 3.4 to 3.6 increase over last year. That's pretty good. We're hopeful that we'll reach that. I think, there was some reservations before the elections. How are they going to turn out? Are we going to have another downswing, I guess I should say, in the recession? I know that's some concern of some Vermonters, but I think, things are slowly leveling out, and we're finding our way after this election, and we are looking for another increase this year.
So
we're
being
hopeful.
Post-election, you think will help, regardless of how you feel about the election? It's the fact that we're through it, so there may be some stability in some people's minds?
We're hoping, yes. One thing that we've noticed is the community outreach after the election. Vermont is such a fantastic community as a whole, and we really do lean on each other as a community, as retailers, retailers on consumers, et cetera. So, we have that community relationship, and I think that because we have those relationships, we are hopeful.
We heard from Karen Walton of Green Mountain Transit about the free ride day on Saturday. Can you talk a little bit about communities around the state that are hosting events that are sort of in conjunction with this idea of Small Business Saturday to try to get people out to their local shops?
Well, I think it varies by every town, right? I certainly don't have an exhaustive list. We have so many fantastic small towns here in Vermont. I know Bennington has an event going on. Rutland, all of the small businesses in Rutland are banding together to promote a shopping, a Small Business Saturday shopping event. Montpelier, they've always got plenty of opportunities and, get out and There was one group, I can't remember which town it was, but it was an elf on the shelf challenge, you know, find an elf on the shelf in each store and you get a stamp and you get, your name gets into a drawing, you know, so they have some pretty exciting and out of the box ideas to get consumers out and shopping.
Where will you be on Small Business Saturday?
Oh, that's a good question. Unfortunately, I will be out of state visiting family for Thanksgiving. So if I were in Vermont, I would probably be in downtown Montpelier.
Although there are small businesses all over the country, so I suppose wherever you are, you can support local businesses.
Yes, I will definitely be shopping in my hometown.
Which is?
Waterloo, New York.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you in Waterloo, New York when you get there. Erin Segrist is president-elect of the Vermont Retail and Grocers Association. Thanks very much for talking with us about Small Business Saturday.
Yes. Thank you, Jane.
And we close today with a musical story from our colleague James Stewart at VPR Classical. His music education series called Timeline introduces us to events, characters, and concepts that shaped Western music. Today's story is of particular interest to all of us who love radio. It's the history of audio recordings.
Of all the advancements of the 20th century, the advent of recording technology has affected the world of music like no other. For centuries, classical music was the privilege of the rich and powerful. It was relegated to the church, concert hall, opera house, or salon. But today, we can access the masterpieces of any era, anytime, anywhere, played by the world's most talented musicians. The story of recording begins in 1857 with the French inventor Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville. He developed the phonautograph. This machine used a cone to capture sound and transfer it to a stylus that carved a path through soot-covered paper. It was supposed to show the wave that sound creates and could not play the sound back to you. Today, with our technology, we have scanned that paper and have attempted to recreate the first examples of a recorded human voice. We believe that this is Scott himself singing the French folk song Au Clair de la Lune on April 9, 1860. In 1877, Thomas Edison patented the phonograph.
I am the Edison phonograph.
This device could record sound and play it back. It used cylinders coated in tin or wax, and the stylus either etched into the cylinder for recording or followed a pre-etched path for playback. It was originally meant for office use or business communication, but it soon became apparent that there was a market for entertainment on this device. The drawback was that pre-recorded cylinders were difficult to reproduce. 10 years later, the gramophone, created by Emil Berliner, introduced a horizontal disc for recording and playback. This format made reproduction much simpler. Until the 1920s, most recording and playback devices were purely mechanical, wind-up machines with varying speeds. Recording took place around the cone of the machine itself. There was no mixing or post-production. In fact, due to restrictions of the technology, it was sometimes necessary to have the musicians play to multiple devices or perform the same piece over and over again in order to ensure an adequate amount of copies for sale. Also, certain instruments recorded better than others. Brass instruments like the trumpet or tuba were much more successful on these devices than the cello or double bass. All of this changed with the creation of electrical recording and the microphone. This device leveled the playing field of instruments and increased the entire range of what could be recorded. Recordings began to sound more and more like a live performance.
That's VPR Classical host James Stewart. This story aired in his series Timeline, which explores the development of Western music. Timeline is made possible in part by a grant from the Ida and William Rosenthal Foundation. You can listen to all the stories in Timeline by subscribing to the podcast. Details are at vpr.net. And boy, aren't you glad that radio today does not sound like it did back at the beginning of those early audio recordings. If you want me to just hum like that guy did for 20 minutes, I'd happily do that. But I think you more appreciate the stories we have here on Vermont Edition. And tomorrow, on the day before Thanksgiving, we'll discuss what we mean when we talk about gratitude and thankfulness. Tell us what you're grateful for. Or if you're feeling ungrateful, you can tell us that too. Shoot a note to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us for a discussion about gratitude tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.